We continue now through Aristotle's Metaphysics, and I've reached a point where he raises the question, is there a science, that means certain knowledge, of first principles of reasoning? If so, does it include the first principles of substance? Does it include ontology of knowledge, a proof? The axioms of reason are the most universal of all, he says. And they are the principles of all things. We've just covered that last time. We looked at the logical law of non-contradiction, and then at a couple of systems that were able to evaluate arguments, seeing whether, if the premises were true, the conclusions had to be true too. And that's what we need to do as we debate these issues and go through them. So Aristotle is here saying, is there a science of this? And of course we would say, yes, it's called logic. Do sensibles really exist? And that means, do they have an independent substance? Or is only mathematical and only the mathematicals and the forms have independent existence? Does the science of the subsistence include only the essential characteristics of things? Are the principles that we seek classifications? Is that the way to think of them? Or are they parts of the things that we're trying to give account of? And if they're classifications, are they all proximate? Or is it only the higher classifications that have this kind of certainty? Especially this, besides matter, what else may be self-caused and have independent existence? Also, we want to know whether there is only one such thing or many. And as to definitions, we want to know about the substratum, about matter, the matter of which a thing is made. And we want to know if they're perishable. Now, this sounds familiar. It ought to. He's already raised all these questions. He's gone through some preliminary answers. He's raised some objections. And now we find he's raising these issues again in perhaps a slightly different way. Remember what I said about this book, as is true of all his writings that we have. They're collected class notes. So it's perfect, makes perfect sense that he may raise these issues, deal with some of them, then raise them again, deal with others, or add to what he said the first time. He says, we want to know whether these are perishable, and when the substance of perishable things, whether they're universal or like individuals. Again, he's thinking of Plato. Is the form another individual instance of, but the perfect instance of, this class of things, this type of things? Or is it something different? He objects then, he reminds you of the criticism he already made. The Platonists make the forms to be nothing more than eternal, sensible things. How could the perfect form, say, for blue or green, be itself blue or green unless it's sensorily perceivable? But if it's sensorily perceivable, it's not a form. It's a perception. So again, he raises the objection and gives it a little more punch this time. Aristotle is going to say that there's two senses in which we use the word substance. We've already covered this too. But now he's going to say the first sense is of this thing. So if I pick up this water bottle, that's a substance. This desk is a substance. The tablet I'm writing on is a substance. So is the stylus with which I'm writing. It's of this. We point to it, and it exists in the world around us. But then there's a second sense, secondary substance. And that is what stands under appearances. And is the permanent abiding essence and identity, I'm going to put, of the thing. So he's going over something he did before, but now he's going into more detail. There is a science that investigates the being of things, just as insofar as they exist. And it investigates the characteristics that being has in virtue of its own nature. This is not the same as any of the so-called special sciences, for none of these treats universality as being. Treats universally of being as being, excuse me. They cut off a part of being and investigate the attribute of this part or that part. They do that in math. They do that in geometry. They do that in physics. They take apart its being insofar as its matter, energy, and its effects, or its being insofar as its spatial forms, sizes, shapes, and locations, or its being insofar as it is quantities calculated. All right. But if we just we want to know what the being is that's common to them all. Remember, that's the way I put this whole question of ontology. And here he's affirming it. Not a part cut off. Therefore, it's a being as being that we have to grasp the first causes. Evidently, then, he goes on, it belongs to the philosopher to inquire into the principles of reasoning and the syllogism. And the most certain principle of all is that regarding which it is impossible to be mistaken. Such a principle must be both the best known and non-hypothetical. It's not a guess on our part. Right? Remember, hypothesis, theory means our best educated guess as to what's going on. That's not it. Can't be a hypothesis. And this is that the same attribute cannot at the same time belong and not belong to the same subject in the same respect. This, then, is the most certain principle of all. For it is impossible for anyone to believe the same thing to be and not be. Remember, he adds, what a man says he doesn't necessarily believe. So there are people who try just to be perverse in an argument to say, no, I both believe and I believe A and not A. I believe they're both true. And then it turns out that he doesn't, says Aristotle. He's just trying to give you a bad time. It's impossible that there should be demonstration of absolutely everything. And this first principle, least of all, nothing would prove it. It's used in proving and testing everything else. So since we can't get a proof of everything, that would require an infinite regress. You remember his objection of that. There must be a cause or explanation sufficient for everything, where sufficient means complete. It comes to an end or you don't have it. So there has to be a sufficient reason for this too. And it is self-evident. It's impossible there should be demonstration of everything. That would require an infinite regress. But if there are propositions, then that we should, of which we should not demand a demonstration, and nothing could be more self-evident than this one. Both that the same thing can't be true and false in the same sense at the same time. Now, Aristotle is the one who's going to go on in when he talks about self-evidence, he's going to discuss that, and he's going to say that it's not enough for something to be genuinely self-evident that we experience it that way, that something is experienced as prima facie true. This means, of course, that it's not derived from any other information. Now, let me explain that. That doesn't mean that you don't have to know anything else to have this experience. It may be, let's use a concrete example. Many years ago, I had a summer job assisting a guy who tuned pianos and pipe organs. And I learned how to tune pianos. Now, it is now self-evident to me if I hear a piano that's out of tune with itself, or somebody sings out of tune with the piano, or whatever it is. That just strikes me right away. I think, whoa, they're having trouble. It's not in tune. I don't reason to that. I don't have premises and draw the conclusion this piano's out of tune. I hear it. That doesn't mean there was no training involved in me coming to be able to hear it. Understand? There was training. There was a time when I couldn't hear it. And then I got a little better and a little better and so on. But that the piano is out of tune is not derived from other information. I don't put down the other information and then in a syllogism infer the conclusion that the piano is out of tune. It's not information. It's not independent of my experience. I have to hear the piano to know it's out of tune. It's not independent of my training and background. But that's not pieces of information that lead to the conclusion the piano is in tune or is not in tune. I hope that helps to illustrate what I mean here when I put down its experience is prima facie true and not derived from other information. That doesn't mean, however, there are no other conditions that have to hold. I need to have the training. I need to have a clear path of hearing the piano now. Then I can tell that it is or isn't out of tune. Now, what Aristotle does is add to this experience, this direct and immediate experience that something is so, he adds three conditions. All of which I find highly objectionable. First, he says, that all the experts in the field have to agree. In other words, if I hear the piano and I hear it out of tune, and somebody else is a musician and says, I don't hear any problem, then I can't claim that it's self-evident that it's out of tune. Because all the experts are going to have to agree. Later on, all experts was changed by René Descartes to everybody has to agree. Descartes says, anyone who is in the least degree rational will see the self-evidence of this truth if it's really self-evident. All right, that's the first restriction. So the experience of self-evidence can be proper grounds for believing that something is true, provided that either everybody or at least all the experts agree with you, provided it is an end truth. An end truth means a necessary truth. Provided it is a necessary truth. What's that mean? It means that it's a law. Now that rules out knowing that the piano is out of tune by hearing it, because that's not a law. Right? Whether the piano is in or out is in fact the case. It's something that's in fact true, but it's not a necessary truth. It's not like 1 + 1 = 2, or things equal to the same thing or equal to each other. It's not a law. And Aristotle added a third thing, and he said, that it yields an infallible truth. Whoa. So if something is self-evident, and it is to everybody, and it's a law, then it cannot be wrong. There are no circumstances under which you could be mistaken about it. Whoa, Nelly. Let's just think about them for a minute. I've already told you I don't like any of them, so it's time for me to make good and tell you why. Let's take the first one, the everybody requirement. It won't matter whether we consider it to be everybody has to agree, anyone who's in the least degree rational, or at least all the experts have to agree. It doesn't matter. Because there's no way ever to tell for anything whatever that everybody agrees with you. In logic, everybody means irrespective of time. It doesn't mean all the people right around you right now. It means all the people who ever lived and all the people who ever will live. Everybody means everybody. So how are you going to tell for any truth whatever that everybody agreed with it and always will? It doesn't help to change it to all the experts, because that means all the experts, past and future, as well as present. And there's just no way to tell on all the people who have died and all the people who have yet to be born. So the first thing is that if this is a rule, there's no way to apply it. And the second is, if there's no way to apply it, why think it's a rule? What does it add to anything? All it would do, if we insisted on it, would be to rule out that there's such a thing as self-evident truth. And that Aristotle does not want to do. He has already given you a reason, a good one, I think, for thinking that there are such things. He says the regress of proofs, this proves this, this proves this, this proves this, and that can't go on forever. If it did, you'd never get the proof, because you'd never finish. But we don't have an infinite regress in the things that we know. We don't all know them all. By inference, we don't know them all by making logical arguments, putting down premises, and drawing conclusions. A lot of our information we get because we just see that it's so. Normal sense perception should have been the class example of self-evident truths, but he ruled that out because he thought perception was inferior to purely rational knowledge, and so he follows Plato and debunking it. Since normal sense perception is rescued by reason, you can know things by sense perception, but just the bare perception itself is not going to be sufficient for him. Reason has to come in and do certain operations and show that the perception's okay, and then it's knowledge. So it's more due to reason than perceiving. All right, I won't even argue with that for now, but what good is a requirement that you can't apply to anything whatever? How would you ever know that everybody agreed with you? And would it really be the case? I mean, think about this. Suppose everybody that ever lived agreed with you, and everybody who's ever going to be born agreed with you, except Joe Schmo down the road. He says, no, it doesn't look self-evident to me. Therefore, it's not. Would you really toss it on those grounds? All right, let's try the next one. It only counts, self-evidence only counts, if it's used on a truth that's supposed to be a necessary truth, a truth that's supposed to be a law of some kind. Right? There are truths of fact. In fact, you are viewing this tape right now. That's a fact. That's not a law. But then there are other statements that are laws. I gave a couple of examples. Things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. We learned in geometry, right? That's supposed to be a law. Universal gravitation is a law. The second law of thermodynamics is that every open system gains in entropy. We can go on. There are all kinds of examples. You know them as well as I. Now, here's the problem with this. When I ask, what about this restriction? What about the statement, it's got to be a necessary truth? Is that self-evident, or do you have proof of that? The fact is, he can't answer that it's self-evident. You see why? Because that requirement itself would then either have to be a law or it couldn't be self-evident. It sure doesn't look like a law. Why would it be a law that a self-evident truth has to be a necessary truth? Let me give you an example to make more concrete where this objection has come from and is headed. If the only self-evident truths were ones that were laws, then it couldn't be self-evident to me that that piano's out of tune. Okay? That's an example. I already gave it. I'll use the one I already gave. It's not a law. This requirement that Descartes is adding, let's suppose it's supposed to be a law. The question is it really? Is it really a necessary truth that for anything to be self-evident, it has to be a necessary truth? How would you go about answering that question? You can't claim to know that it's self-evident, because unless you already know it's necessary, it can't be self-evident. That's what he's saying. So it can't be self-evident. From what premises are you going to deduce this is a necessary truth? What's going to be more basic? What's going to yield the conclusion all self-evident truths must be necessary truths? And what's going to do that, that's going to be convincing in the face of so many counterexamples? Counterexample of hearing the piano being out of tune. The counterexample of dropping a rock on your toe and you feel the rock hit your toe, then you know it hit your toe. But that's not the conclusion of a proof. It's self-evident. But it's not a law. And it isn't obviously true to everybody who hears the statement. Somebody who hears George Zilch drop the rock on his toe and he's 10 states away, he doesn't know whether that's true or it isn't. It's not true to everybody. And it's not a necessary truth. Who cares? What's the difference whether it's a necessary truth? This is arbitrary. This is just saying he's setting it up the way he wants it to come out. And look at the last one. If it is self-evident and it's a necessary truth, then it cannot be false. There are no circumstances under which it is conceivably false. What a lot of rot. Look. Suppose we take something like 1 plus 1 makes 2. And we say, this is self-evident to me. And he says, that's okay, that's a necessary truth. Right? It is. It's a necessary truth. It's supposed to be true under any circumstances that 1 and 1 will make 2. Now, as Whitehead has pointed out, however, it takes a certain kind of 1 and 1 to make 2. We have to be talking about abstract numbers and numbers in the natural number series and so on, because, as Whitehead comments, a spark and gunpowder are two things, and when put together, they make an explosion very unlike two things. Okay, so it's got to be the right sort of one and the right sort of together and so on. All right, we give them all that. Why would it be that it's impossible to be mistaken? Now, I can think of circumstances under which it could be mistaken. Suppose there are Alpha Centaurians circling around the Earth in their spaceship, and they're bombarding people with the tachyon waves and making them all think that 1 and 1 is 2. Isn't that a set of circumstances under which it would look right but not be? I'm not saying that's true. I'm saying that's a conceivable set of circumstances, right? Infallible here doesn't mean that just that I can't be wrong this time. It means about this judgment, it is impossible for anyone to make a mistake. If you can think of any circumstances under which you could be mistaken, then it's not infallible. Well, I just thought of some. Somebody's got a brainwave machine in the next room, and they're bombarding you, and they're making you think that something or other is true. And it would look just as true to you as it does now without the machine. I can't think of any belief for which there aren't some circumstances that you might be mistaken. And that even goes for the beliefs that are supposed to be incorrigible, beliefs that are of our own internal states. You know, the belief like, I have an ache in my right knee. How could you be mistaken about that? Seems to me sometimes people have been. They thought it was in their knee. Well, not really. Oh, I guess not. It's my thigh that hurts. They push around on their knee and it doesn't hurt. They push up a little higher and it does. People have been mistaken about stuff like that. These restrictions look to me to be completely arbitrary. What's the reason to believe the restrictions? Are they self-evident? Do they have proof? And the answer is that none of them can be self-evident because they don't fulfill their own requirements. And none of them can be proven. So the heck with them. Just junk them. I've got a clincher here, though. Notice that what Aristotle has done is give us these three restrictions, and then it is clear that God, as Aristotle defines God, passes, right? This is pure form. It's necessary. It's all the experts are going to agree with it. We can't be wrong about it. But the God of Scripture is ruled out. In other words, this is religiously biased, so that his idea of divinity passes and is self-evident, and any other idea of divinity doesn't pass and is not self-evident. It's not something you can applaud. Find it totally and utterly without merit and unconvincing. Now he goes on. I want to apply the word substance to four main objects, he says. This is book Zeta of the Metaphysics. I want to apply it to the essence of a thing, the universal classification, genus, and even to the substratum, the matter that gets formed, informed, put into a certain form. That which is primary in reality. Primary without qualification must be the substance. And there are several senses in which a thing is said to be first. But substance is first in all of them. This definition in the order of knowledge and in the order of time. Substances are primary in every one of those senses. This is secondary substance. It's the essence of a thing, the what it is to be a whatever it is, what it is to be a tree, the what it is to be a human, what it is to be a horse. The definition is primary for being able to know and recognize the thing as what it is. In the order of knowledge, that's what we know first. That's what we know best. That's what he means. And in the order of time. When all else is stripped away, evidently nothing but matter remains. This is a quote now. I'm reading his words. Therefore, the ultimate substratum is itself neither a particular thing nor a particular quantity nor otherwise positively characterized. This makes matter substance. Now, this is a concession on Aristotle's part. You understand? He wants to say here that when you strip away, and he means mentally, you strip away all else that's true of a thing. What is left is the matter on which the form is impressed, which the form is expressed. So what we do is take away anything that's all quantity, he says. Or any other positive characterization. Strip it all away, and what will be left is the matter of the thing. No, it's not. If you strip away everything, what's left is absolutely nothing. Let's try it. Let's take a physical object, this stylus that I've been using to write. It certainly has physical characteristics, does it not? It's solid. It's smooth. It's hard. It has specific gravity. It has a physical composition. If I knew what kind of plastic it was made of, I'd know what chemical composition that had, and so on. But if we take away all its non-physical characteristics, everything about it that's not physical, we would take away first its quantity. Aristotle says that. There's no how much. This can't be measured or counted. Quantitative properties aren't physical properties, right? We're taking away everything that's not physical. Quantitative properties are related by mathematical laws, not by physical laws. Quantitative properties are gone then. We take them out of our concept of this thing. We're doing this mentally, right? Mentally we remove the quantity. Now we remove the spatial shape, size, and location, because space and its measurements and so forth are also not physical. Spatial shapes aren't physical objects. They're related to one another by geometric and other mathematical laws. We'll take away its sensory perception, the fact that it looks off-white, feels smooth. All sensory properties are going to be removed because they're not physical either. They're not related by physical laws to one another. In fact, Aristotle's already removed them. They don't count as part of the thing at all. Remember, that's just sensory perception. That's appearance. That doesn't give us the reality at all. We're dismissing that right from the beginning. But you know what else you're going to have to take away? You're going to have to take away all the logical properties of this. You're going to have to take away the rational ones. Because he wants to say positive characterization. Take away every positive characterization. Then you've got to take away logical properties. And you might feel inclined to say to me, wait a minute, that stylus doesn't have logical properties. Logical properties are things like consistent, inconsistent, contradictory, contrary, entailment. They apply to propositions that we write on pieces of paper. Objects don't have logical properties. Oh, but they do. How about the property of being logically distinguishable from anything else? Are you telling me this doesn't have that? It's logically identical with itself. It's logically distinguishable. It's logically conceivable. I can form a logical concept of the stylus. They're all logical properties. They're all properties of the stylus in virtue of the fact that it's subject to logical laws. Finally, as the kicker here, let's take its linguistic properties. You think it doesn't have them either? Does it not have the property of being capable of being referred to in a language? sure it does. And we have to kiss that one off too. Now tell me, what is a stylus that has no quantity, is nowhere, is imperceivable in principle, is not logically distinguishable from anything else, and can't be referred to in any language whatsoever? Is it the case that just its matter is left? I think it's patently self-evident that the answer is no. Nothing is left. Zippo. And he says, that's just the matter. So the matter is itself a kind of substance. That means it has independent existence. The only reason it's not as praiseworthy as the rational truths is that they have independent existence and are changeless, whereas matter has independent existence but changes depending on the form it's combined with. But the arguments don't fly. Sorry, Charlie. When you strip away all the non-physical properties from a thing, you aren't left with a purely physical leftover, a residuum of just the physical. The physical evaporates with all the rest and is gone. So I don't find his restrictions on self-evidence convincing, and I don't find his argument convincing that matter itself is self-existent. He wanted to believe that. He wanted to believe that all the forms, essences, whatever term you want to use, substances, are all eternal, and so is the matter to which they give their form, which is why one bunch of matter is a tree, and another is a horse, and another is a human, and another is a planet, and so on. But the argument doesn't work. There is an essence, he says, only of those things whose formula is a definition. Only those things have an essential definition that have an essential definition, has an essence in the ontological sense. A formula of something primary in being. And primary things are those that do not imply predication of one element from another. He repeats that. That means a real substance can only be the subject of a sentence, not the predicate of a sentence. All right, so that's how we know which things are substances, and there is a formula, that is a definition, of what it is to be that kind of thing, and then we also say that what corresponds to that definition is an essence of it, or a substance. It's that which stands under all its changes as it goes through changes and remains the same identical thing. But we have now seen good reason to conclude that he's been arguing in a circle. He assumes that it's form and matter that are eternal, self-existent, and that the forms are changeless even if the matter changes. And then he tries to give arguments that don't succeed in showing that, but instead beg the question. But once again, he repeats, substance, only substance is definable. Definition is the formula of an essence, right? It's the statement of what the essence of a thing contains, what it includes and rules out. An essence belongs to substances, either only or chiefly, in the unqualified sense. So having started his investigation over again and raised those questions, he gives these arguments and comes to the same conclusion. So they are new arguments. No better than the old ones, I'm afraid, but there are new arguments. And he's trying to pile up the evidence and convince you. So once again, he gives you that formula that I said was toti ein ain't I? The what it is to be. Whatever it is we're talking about. What it is to be. That's the formula. That's the definition. So there's got to be a definition of what it is to be a tree or a horse or whatever. And then that definition corresponds to something real called its essence or substance. The essence is what stands under is all of the other appearances and changes of the thing and remains the same, so that it's to guarantee the identity of that thing. And you remember I already objected that that doesn't work in principle, because what's supposed to be the identity of the individual is a general formula. It's a universal formula. The definition of a tree applies to all trees. It doesn't tell you about this individual one and why it survived the forest fire. This certainly economizes on Plato. That's one of the things he wanted to do. He doesn't have a form for every bleeding quality in the world and every shade of every quality and every nuance of every quality, as well as all things that possess qualities. He does cut down on that. Colors and dimes and points, negatives, colors go away, not to mention the perfect turd in the other world, all go away because they're not primary. They must be attributed to something. So mathematical qualities are attributed to this, that, or the other thing. Colors are attributed to this, that, or the other thing. So are quantities. So they are not themselves substances. Instead, each concrete object has its own essence, which is its own being. And has its own self-existent substance. Notice he's also denied Plato's doctrine of self-predication. Remember, for Plato, each form was an instance of its own quality. So the perfect form for green is green. And the perfect square in the form world was a perfect square. And so on. And he has done away with that as well. The substance of all horses is in the horses, not in another world. And it's not another horse in the form world that all horses here copy. It's the formula of what it is to be a horse. And that's an essential, that is an essence of the thing, which is its substance. And then, of course, matter can't be eliminated from his picture of reality, because that's what gets formed into these different things. So let's ask ourselves now, let's stop and raise one more question. We have just a few minutes to go here. Is this really an account of the things that we experience around us in the world? Or has it gotten so highly artificial and so removed from them that we hardly recognize them at all? Remember that for Aristotle, all the sensory properties of a thing have been removed. They don't count as any real part of the object anyhow. When I look out the window and I see a tree, and I see its graceful boughs and the leaves on the tree, and I see the bark and so on, all of those things that appear to me, its every appearance is dismissed. It's not really part of the tree. And in that sense, he's not accounting for what we normally experience every day. I experience the tree as having sensory properties, but not just them. The sensory properties are properties of this object. And I may want to know, well, what is there more to the object? Well, there's a lot more. I think the objects have mathematical and spatial properties. They have physical properties. They have sensory properties and logical properties. And if it's a tree, it has biological properties. I think it has all the kinds of properties it appears to have. Why should I deny any of them? Well, then how about his account? Does it really tell us about the identity of a thing and the cause of it? It's what he's trying to preserve. The appearances can be deceiving. The appearances can change. But it's the same exact, identical, individual thing that functions, that has all these changes occur to it. What is it then that's the permanent abiding identity of it? And he makes that a formula. A formula, a definition. Here's what it is to be a tree. Now, these words correspond to a something called its essence. Really? And that's what you know, the essences. Because they're substance, they abide. I think what abides is the tree. The tree I see. It changes, it lost a couple limbs in the last storm, same tree. How can what is true of all trees be the identity of this tree? You understand? I've made that point before, I make it again. And does it really account for us, does it give us a good account of the natures of things? Let me check these down so that you have them. Does this account really tell us about things as we experience them? Does it tell us about the identity of those things? I'd say no. And does it tell us about the natures of those things? Well, insofar as it tells me about the definition of a tree, it tells me something about the nature of a tree. Yes, it does. I'm not saying it tells us nothing. It's partially successful. But if I'm the gardener, and I have to tend this garden, and I'm concerned about this tree, what I want to know about this tree has to do with this one. Not what's generally true of trees of this type. But I want to know how this one is responding to what I'm feeding it, to my treatment, to my pruning. And by experience, I know that even if the trees are of the same type, they do not all react the same ways to the same things. So the answer to the third question about the natures of things is, well, it's a partial account. I don't think the account accounts for things as we experience them at all. I don't think it tells us anything about their identity, because their identity is our identity as individuals, and all it tells us about is the type. And then finally, the natures of the things, well, yes, it tells us something about that, but not much. In fact, it's probably not what I really need to know if I own the trees and they're in an orchard and I want to maximize their fruit production or something like that. I may have to do different things with different individual trees, even if they're of the same biological kind. The things being experienced then the things being explained are not being explained as we experience them. No. They've had their sensory appearance dismissed right at the beginning. So I think Aristotle is in large measure guilty of what he accused Plato of. He tries to explain the identity of a changing thing with a changeless subject. How can the identity of a material thing be immaterial? How can the logical form of a thing cause to be what isn't logical? Affect the matter, in other words. How can it be that what is purely logical, actual, and changeless unites or interacts with what is purely physical, potential and changeable. And if it did happen, how could those things interact to produce all the other kinds of properties that things display? No adequate answer. But our time is up, and I will see you next session.